because you're jumping back into the gap. I'll let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind basketballimmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. I'm excited to have a basketball coaching conversation with Dave Love. Dave Love is an NBA shooting coach, having worked for three teams and with dozens of NBA players to improve their shooting. You can follow him on social media at Coach Dave Love or subscribe to his free newsletter. The biggest thing for me, Coach, is I know you're a sharer. I mean, that's why we've originally connected, is that through online and through your presence in so many different avenues. I mean, it's almost a disservice to call you just an NBA shooting coach because you're clearly not. You work with all levels, you coach all levels, and you're willing to share the game. And I value that, and I appreciate you taking time to join us today.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's kind of how I was brought up, where I had a mentor that was very, very generous with his time. And I almost feel like how I pay him back, I never can pay him back for all that he did for me. But the only way that I can really try is by doing that for other people as well. So.
Well, that's outstanding. And I've been fortunate that you've been willing to share in the past. I put a blog on, which I'll put in the show notes, but advice from an NBA shooting coach and talking a little bit about random versus block shooting practice. So I encourage coaches to go read that on basketballimmersion.com, but let's get into it. Let's start with the best question. Is there a perfect shooting technique?
No, of course not. Everybody has a different body and different habits, and we can look back at all the great shooters and see countless examples within. If you pick the top 10 shooters of all time, whoever you deem those to be, you're probably going to find 10 different ways of doing things, and there'll be some similarities, but there will also be some stark contrasts. And I think it's important as a shooting coach that you understand a shot and you understand how it works and where you're able to compromise. And then a couple of the physical non-negotiables, as I call them, that need to translate from player to player. But within that, there's a lot of wiggle room.
Well, and that leads into the next question perfectly, which is call them absolutes, call them commonalities of all shooters, and you call them non-negotiables. What are those non-negotiables that apply to all shooters regardless of their technique?
Well, and even within the non-negotiables, I mean, there's gray areas because it's a dynamic game. But for me, I want players to be on balance. I want them to, within that balance, have a chance to keep their shot as simple as possible. Depending on what the defender is giving them. I want them to be able to shoot the middle of the basketball, and I want them to be able to get their non-shooting hand off the ball.
Obviously, for me, the one that stands out that I think is maybe the most debated is shooting in the middle of the ball. It's not really a debate, I mean, in my mind, but people talk on, and I know as coaches, we can get into these debates that last forever that probably have very little useful purpose beyond the initial inquiry, but middle finger, index finger, I've read some of your stuff before. Is that something that's individual or is that something that you find very specific to get to the middle of the ball?
It is individual, but I do find that a vast majority of players, if you look at the way they grip the basketball, if they spread their thumb out relatively wide as they should be, that the distance between the tip of their index finger to the tip of their thumb will be almost exactly the same as the tip of the index finger to the tip of their pinky. And if we can be aware of that, then geographically, that index finger is the middle of most people's hands. I would say it's probably about 90%. And then with a connected but different idea, when players get to their shot set point or a shot pocket, whatever you want to call that position, where in the basketball's forehead height, again, 90% of players end up with their index finger on the bottom of the ball. So if we have the index finger is the middle of your hand geographically, and most players end up with the index finger on the bottom of the ball at their set point, then if we can lift in a straight line from that set point, we have a chance to consistently keep the ball online. So there are some hand shapes and bodies that are built a little bit differently that fall in that 10%, but I would say most players do fall into the 90%.
Well, I love that explanation. It's simple to understand and simple to convey to a learner as well. And people, I think as coaches, sometimes we feel like we can do everything. Like right. We feel like we know everything because we coach. But I think when I look at someone like you and I say, what is your value? I mean, beyond obviously your intellect and your insight, it's the experience of having worked with so many players that you have these experiences of saying, from this sample size, here's what I find is the most successful. Is that true? That sample size of focusing on one thing?
100%. And what I learned, people ask me, how do you become a shooting coach? And really, you call yourself a shooting coach and you start working with players. And it's becoming a shooting coach that's the challenge. And so what I found early on with the first individual player that I worked with, that I had to discover a path to be able to get that player from wherever he was at that point to more successful. And based on his habits and his needs, you figure out that path to get that player to succeed at a higher rate. And then you start working with the second player and you realize their path is different. And so some of the things that you did with the first player might apply to the second, but they'll have a totally different bad habit that you need to correct and you need to figure out how to get them. So now you've worked with two players and you now have two paths. And then you work with a third, and it's a couple of the ideas that you worked with those first two players may apply, but you may also have to come up with some other ideas in a third path. And you're adding tools to your tool belt. And it's why I continue to do youth clinics, because every once in a while I'll have a more elite player and you'll see something in their mechanics that you know isn't quite right, but maybe it's, you haven't seen it quite that way before, and you're trying to wrap your brain around, okay, what is happening in that fraction of a sec? What is the movement that's being made? And then I go off to do a clinic in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and you see a kid with a similar habit, and for some reason, when you see it in that kid, it registers with, oh, that's what they do. And you can now take from the kid to the elite player and go, okay, now I figured out what is actually happening that I couldn't see for the first month or so, and apply it. So it's almost, I use the analogy of professional poker players will play online poker because they can have 8 different laptops going and get more reps with different hands and how to play different hands. And so the clinics are my online poker, so to speak.
That's a fascinating connection there in terms of from a pro player to a youth player, but I'll ask you and I'll circle back to this later when we talk about the differences between working with both groups, but just the fact that you have that sample size is so impressive. And obviously that's what leads to potential expertise in your field, whatever the field is. In this case, we're talking about shooting.
Right.
But for a coach that is a youth coach or a high school coach that doesn't have access to a shooting coach, what are some of the things that they can do in the absence of hiring you to be able to focus on shooting in the best way possible, considering obviously they have limited time, limited resources, all these different things?
Yeah, those are the, in a lot of ways, I have it easier than youth coaches. And I think there's the natural perception that more elite coach or the higher level coach must have it harder. I don't think we do. I think the youth coach has it hard because they only get 2 hours of gym time a week and never in on an individual basis. Like you, I'm guessing this time of year, we're end of May, early June, you're getting a lot of time with individuals within your program.
Yeah. And then generally I do, you know, more group training because of the decision-making part of it that I'm trying to right. bring more of that into play. But certainly when we do shooting, we focus on more isolated training with shooting, and because it's very individual. And obviously that connects back to what you're saying, which is it's really challenging for a coach in a group setting to develop shooting. And I've always felt that that's the case. That's the one skill that I'll train in isolation.
Right. And so for those youth coaches that maybe only get 2 hours of gym time and only in a group setting, I think it's important to only bite off what you can chew. Is that the expression? That doesn't seem
yes.
right. But only bite off what you can chew. And every 8-year-old, probably every part of their shot is flawed. And that's fine. They should be enjoying the game at that point. But to try and correct everything, you're probably going to be unsuccessful and have an emotional breakdown at some point. But if you can just kind of focus on an 8 or 10 or 11-year-old balance and then turn your attention to when they become 11 and 12 to how they grip the basketball. And then when they're in that 12, 13, 14 year old range, okay, what does their shooting motion look like? And I think that's where a lot of, we're both Canadians, I'll speak to sort of the Canadian youth program, where we have in my hometown, Calgary Minor Basketball, and 3,000 kids playing semi-organized basketball, but with lower level coaches. And I think that's where they can take the next big step, is to develop a shooting program where they're identifying.
Shooting programs outside of regular practice time. So in addition to, is that what you're saying? Or within the scope of it?
Or even with their practice to teach these moms and dads who may have a bit of a coaching background, but probably not much, just to say, hey, don't bite off more than you can chew. Just with these younger age groups, start with this, and here's a couple of drills that you can do it, and try and spend 15 minutes of your 1 hour practice every week on these ideas, and really teaching the coaches on how to coach that particular age group. And then, so the kids will be in the, within this program for potentially 6, 7, 8 years. And if the program can set up, all right, at 8, 9, 10 years old, we want to focus on this. And at 11 and 12, we want to focus on this, and really help the coaches build and provide the drills. That's something that I'm working to build so that we can provide for these bigger programs.
Well, and I love that. And I love that out the box thinking, because for me, I've always thought that we should be, like, even in Canada with, I think we have a really good development model, that we should be focusing on teaching parents how to shoot and how to teach shooting, whether it's just a progression of drills or just some little technique things. Because ultimately, they're the ones that are developing their son or daughter's shots more than the coach, because they work with them more. Like, they're rebounding for their son or daughter, especially in that pre-pubescent age group, which you're talking about a little bit in that 11, 12, when they start to get more of a concept of shooting. And I don't know, coach, before we even get to that point, should we be worrying about shooting? Like, in a pre-pubescent age group, should we be just focused on initial concept? Or what should we be doing? Because there's so many skills that we have to develop as a coach. Is shooting the most important at that age group, or has it become a late development skill?
When you're talking prepubescent, you're talking sort of in the 8 to 10-year-old range, is that sort of?
Yeah, before they mature. I mean, we know at that age that, you know, they don't have the strength. Even though we, in the ideal world, we get the smaller ball and we modify the hoops, we understand the administrative logistics of that. The reality is, it's just not going to happen everywhere. At that age group, like, what should be the goal? Because I know we're correcting, we end up correcting, you and I, a lot of habits that are formed at a young age that they never break out of. For example, shooting from their chest.
Right.
Just a strength thing that developed. And then I find in high school, players are still shooting there because they developed a comfort from that.
Right. Non-shooting hand over-involvement.
Yeah, absolutely. It
starts at 8 years old and never gets corrected, or hopefully eventually gets corrected. To answer your question, how much should we be focusing on it? I think at that sort of 8-year-old range, I have an 8-year-old daughter. And at this point, like, I'm planting seeds and I'm trying to get her in a fun way to mimic a shooting motion with good balance and not even a basketball in her hand, but just being able to copy a motion that she sees me making or sees Klay Thompson making. And just giving her little reminders to, hey, don't forget to get your feet wide. Don't forget that thumb needs to be out wide. And we're just planting seeds. Now, when she goes and she actually shoots on a hoop, a lot of it goes out the window.
Of course.
And so I kind of focus on balance at that point. But even at this age, I just want her to have fun. I want her to enjoy the game. And I want her to start to understand what some of the things that we're working on that we might work on later could be. And I think that's coaching in general, that if we can proactively coach, we're going to be significantly more successful than if we can reactively coach. And that's over the last 5 or 6 years where I've made a big improvement, where I now know what the challenges that players are going to face are, and that they can start off in the first month of rebuilding a shot and they start off doing great. Like, we're keeping things simple. We're doing simple ideas and shooting close in shots, and they're doing really well with it. And even though that's happening in their ear, just saying, not every day is going to be perfect. Like, we're riding a little hot streak right now, and that's great. I'm going to take every single one of these. But when we have a bad day, let's not panic and let's not assume that we've regressed. It's just a lesser day. And right now you've had a lot of A pluses in a row. If we have a B minus, that's fine. And then when that B minus day comes along, I've prepared them for that and am able to just leave it as, see, I told you this was going to happen. Like, it's nothing to panic about. We knew, we talked about this many times that we're going to have bad days and that we're going to continue to have bad days. And when you get into training camp, the first day you're probably going to fall apart just a tiny little bit, because for the first time in 3 months, you're going to be shooting a new shot in front of teammates. And that's going to be in the back of your mind. If you have a bad day, we're just going to push through it and just keep working the same way that we always have. And the bad days will end. And you're just constantly preparing somebody for what you know they're going to face down the road.
And that's the underrated part of about our job as a coach and a job as a skills trainer, is that part of our responsibility when we're dealing with young people is retention. Like, we want them to enjoy the process of training, the process of getting better, but also we want them to experience some success or notice some progress, which is basically what you're saying there, is you're noticing progress, but you're also noticing it in a very realistic way. Because the reality is you're not going to make all your shots. So building that, I think, is really important for coaches to understand that you're spending as much time getting them to understand that.
So when I look at your stuff, Chris, and I have a lot of admiration for what you do, it's like, I want to phrase this and make sure that it doesn't sound diminishing at all. You seem to do a really good job of allowing for the fun aspect. And that's where I'm trying to grow myself, is I've been really stringent in the past and focusing on details. How much emphasis do you put on the enjoyment of building a skill?
So it's interesting because, again, through all these experiences I've had working youth camps throughout North America, like you've had, I've got that experience of working with young people, and they've taught me so much that I've brought back to with my players, just like you said, from working with a pro to working with a player. And the one thing is, number one is giving them permission to smile. Like, I just find that too often the coaching atmosphere, I'm sure whether it's skills trainers or coaches, like, we've created this atmosphere of this is really serious and we've got to focus. And believe me, I'm a competitive nut. So it's really hard for me because that's not really my personality. But at the same time, I've got to make sure that I create that environment. And I always say that I'm not a motivator. I'm someone who creates conditions for them to be motivated. And I don't think there's any better lesson, you know, when we're dealing with shooting than that, because you're only going to take it so far as a coach, right?
Right. And so how do you create that permission to smile? Like, how do you grow that?
The most impactful thing, I think, with new recruits and with kids at camp is that I give them permission to shoot the ball, which is amazing. If you say, okay, put up your hands and say, who loves defense? There's a bunch of kids that'll put up their hand. I'll say, you're all liars. Like, you're all liars. What do you really love about basketball? I mean, let's be honest. Coaches have sold you that you love defense because it helps your team win. That's great. But from a purely selfish standpoint, the psychology is, I love to shoot the ball. And I find that so many players that I'm around have been taught how to catch to pass, but not how to catch to shoot every time they catch it. And I'm not saying shoot it every time, but in those type of free environments, I get them to connect with their enjoyment of playing the game, and that's permission to shoot the ball. And if you're open, shoot it, because it's really hard to get open shot. Now, in some cases, some of those young players, they don't have the ability yet to make those shots. But I find the mindset is much more important, because if they do feel permission to shoot it, the hope is that they reconnect with, now I'll work on it. Right? But if you, as a coach, create this condition where, look, Dave, you got to pass the ball 8 times before we shoot it. And if you're open, it doesn't matter. We got to pass it 8 times before you shoot it. That's not going to connect with you very much to say, oh, I should go really work on my shot.
Right.
Like, if anything, you should go work on your pass. But I'm pretty sure you're not doing that either. So I think that's where I come back to retention and enjoyment of the game. So hopefully that makes sense. But that's really been a philosophical change over the last little while.
And it has been a change. It's not your natural personality. It's just something you're growing into.
I'm far too serious. I really am. I'm that guy. Like, I'm far too serious. Yeah. I'm not a joker per se. Like, I have probably a dry wit, you would say. But it's really not my personality to be that happy, smiley cheerleader. But I do it in a different way. Like, I'm not really that cheerleader. I'm a guy that creates a challenge. And then I notice their progress as they're moving towards that challenge. Or I'd say, hey, listen, you couldn't do this yesterday, and now you can do it almost.
Right, well, and that's progress.
That is progress. And I'm like, you should smile. You know, you should enjoy that fact because you know what? You're better than you were yesterday. And that's kind of the thing. Like when I say fun, I connect that to kids like to compete. They like to play the game, right? That's part of our philosophy. But the other part is they like to see themselves get better.
Right.
Right. I'm sure after kids leave your camp, I know they do. They go the next day and they work on their shot. They go the next day and work on their shot because they're really excited. They felt themselves getting better. The challenge is, again, what are they doing 2 weeks later?
Right.
Right. And those are the ones that become the best players.
Yeah. And if we could bottle up something, it would be that it's the awareness that it needs to be a daily thing. And I just talked with one of my players today about everybody puts in a physical effort to get better. And a lot of times the missing component is the mental effort, the awareness of what are you working on and the discipline to hold yourself accountable to doing it. That you're putting in the physical effort anyways, just put in the physical effort into a new idea. And the dumb analogy that I give, and it's extraordinarily dumb, but I think it's effective. I realized when I was about 12 years old that I didn't want to brush my teeth. And so what I did was I figured out my parents would probably check my toothbrush. I wet my toothbrush, but then I thought they may be listening. And so I'm going to rub the toothbrush on the bottom of the faucet to create the brushing sound too. And if they're listening, they're going to,
wow.
I invested all of the calories into brushing my teeth to not brush my teeth.
That's amazing.
And so if players will invest all the calories to the physical calories they would have to burn to build the habit, but just mentally not hold themselves accountable to building it. And when you can just flip that little switch of just potential is out there and you can achieve it, but it takes a little bit of mental energy to do that.
Well, I think we're finding out a little bit about what type of child you were too. So this is awesome.
Right.
I've always framed it as saying that it's a contradiction because shooting is such an unconscious effort. Like really, the goal is that you're effortless shooting it.
Right. But
the process of developing shooting is very much a conscious effort. And it's such a contradiction for a player to be focused on the things that you're talking about. And that's where it comes into play. And look, I knew this conversation would go so many different directions. So let's start with that one that we just brought up. How then do you sell them on a change? How do you sell a player?
That's a great phrasing of the question, because I think a big part of it is sales. And that's what I resisted in the beginning of my coaching career, is that I didn't realize how much you were selling the idea to a player, and it fits in with the being proactive. You kind of have to know, and you have to prepare, and you have to sell what is coming. So how do you go about doing that? I think it varies from every single player. And I think we need to acknowledge that some of it, it's okay for the player to be selfish. It's a selfish act to shoot the basketball. You've deemed that in this moment, you have the best opportunity for the team to score. And so that is selfish, and give them permission to be selfish but smart. And I don't think there's anything wrong with touching on that, that we'll talk to guys at the NBA level of, hey, we want you to develop this skill even more so that we can win more games. Yes. But so you can score more points and you can make more money.
It's a great connection, isn't it, to that, you know, that you have a longer career, you're going to make more money and all these things. Is that stat driven somewhat, or is that video driven when you ultimately get to that final sell? Or
I guess the answer is yes, that it's all those things, and you're trying to search for the one that's really going to resonate with the player, and all these different sales techniques for, you're just trying to find the reason why that particular player will be willing to make the investment. And so I think you need to sometimes look at the stats and sometimes look at the video of your shot and just say, do we really believe that these shooting mechanics are going to lead to more consistency? Or can you see the physics are working against you, or the stats? It's a small physical change that we can't necessarily show you on video or see, but the results just aren't where we want them to be. And we know that you believe in yourself and we believe in you too, but that we need, the ultimate goal is more numbers, points and efficiency. So,
and you would think in this era of basketball, the way the game's being played, certainly at the NBA level and filtering on down, that it should be hard to sell shooting. Like, it really shouldn't, but you know, it's more about how they actually will change. I'm sure that's even the right. finer point of the sell job, right?
Well, and I found, and you'll be able to speak to this, I'd love to hear your opinion as well. People always ask, like, oh, what is the ego like at the NBA level? The ego must be terrible. And I always make the comment that the ego is in line with the ability. And that makes for a relatively easy existence. And when LeBron James knows he's great, and he's great, that works out really well. The problem is more the 12-year-old boy, if I can make a vast generalization, where they believe they're great and the talent doesn't match up. That's where the ego becomes a problem. If the ego is in line with the abilities, you're fine. And have you experienced something similar?
There was not an NBA practice I went to over the course of the season or a workout where I saw anything close to ego being demonstrated. The reception to coaching, the reception to their teammates, directions, every part of that was just on point and from stars on down. It was definitely a message I brought back to my players. And to be honest, even with my players, I mean, I find there's an absence of ego to a certain extent. I mean, part of ego is good, right? Like part of a player wanting to be good or wanting to play more or anything like that is good. And that's another part of it that we actually embrace, is that we're okay with that. We're okay with what you just said, which is selfishness. If you're open, you should be selfish because it's really hard to get good shots. So some of those ways that people traditionally frame things as being negative, we try and frame as being positive. And that's a great line, ego in line with ability. And that certainly applies.
And we're not saying for a second that there aren't sometimes massive disagreements, that everybody gets, and we don't all get along all the time, but there's enough respect of knowledge and ability that the players seem to understand that the coaches are just trying to help. And the coaches are also respect the players enough to ask and value their opinion as well. And the conversations that I have beyond, it's a little different in the first month of getting to know somebody where I may be directing a little bit more. But once we get past that, I'm probably asking their feelings more than the other way around. I'm asking for their input rather than just trying to force feed mine. And there are some disagreements, absolutely. But yeah, I find generally they're the most coachable group. And I wonder also if that's a sort of a natural selection, that you need to be coachable to make the improvements to be able to get to the university level or the pro level? Or is it the other way around?
So for me, maybe you said something about feel there. So I guess it comes back for me to a question is, like, the number one thing I find myself saying to players when I'm working on shooting is, what do you feel? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you, I'm not in your body. What do you feel? Yes. Does this feel right? Because I remember from youth ages, it used to be this whole thing to have your elbow in when you shoot.
Right.
And I just found when I pulled my elbow in too much, I felt tension in my shoulder, but I just trusted coaches and I did it. And I didn't get a good shot until I started to trust myself more and let my shot. Yeah. And say, well, it doesn't feel right.
On my newsletter currently, I have a little giveaway that I offer to sign up for the newsletter. And the title is Three Things That I Never Say, Amateur Coaches Say All the Time. And one of them, I think it might be number one, is get your elbow in. I never say get your elbow in. So if I can go technical for a second with you.
Please, please.
Instead of getting the elbow in, I believe we need to talk about get our index finger or whichever finger we're putting in on the middle of the basketball along the target line. And we're on video right now, so you can see what I'm talking about. But fortunately, the listeners can't. When you're the way my body is built, when my index finger is along that target line, my elbow will be slightly out. And if I were to try and get my elbows in, my index finger actually goes across the target line in the less conventional angle. Usually elbow out is the mistake. And so your index finger would be going across your target line in one direction, elbow too far in, it goes the opposite direction. And I make the analogy of a pool cue. It's not the angle of the cue that determines whether the ball goes in the pocket. It's the point of contact between the two balls that determines where the target ball goes. And how your hand connects to the basketball is infinitely more important than where the joint two levels down the chain of command is. So I hardly ever talk about elbow. And if I do, it's only because I felt like the player is so sick of hearing me say index finger along the target line that I'm trying something that basically means the same thing.
Well, that's great. And coach, I'll put a link to coaches who are listening. I'll put a link to coach's newsletter sign up. And I encourage you to do that because so many of those newsletters have some diagrams and they have some visuals that help you even more. And you know, it's great. Great to see that demonstration because again, that was something from my youth and learning basketball that coaches kind of stuck to that and messed me up. So I'm glad we moved beyond that.
What other things do you remember hearing that you're questioning now as a coach? You know, is this overtaught? Is this overdone? Like the other one that...
Square up. I find that term completely off base. Like,
explain it.
Just in sense that, you know, my feet always got to be pointed towards the basket to be a shooter or to be a driver or whatnot. And when I watch a lot of players, obviously, you know, at the higher level and whatnot, I don't find their feet are always square. So, But I also find that, you know, the term that I try and say, like, I think there's and we always say get low. And I think there's a disadvantage to getting too low too.
Right.
I talk about legs loaded, which is just basically a situation where you're slightly in a squat, not fully in a squat. Cause I don't see anyone, you know, get in a full squat to shoot or, you know, to drive the ball necessarily. It's more about the quickness of your ability to get your feet set and the rhythm of the shot that generates the power than anything from a deep knee bend. And those are things that stuck with me. Am I on base?
One of the other three things that I never say is bend your legs, that the power in your shot comes from your legs.
Right.
That I think 20% of the power from your shot comes from your legs and 80% comes from the elbow. But as human beings, if anything, we tend to forget to use our legs enough, but that doesn't mean that all the power comes from our legs. It's just, maybe we're not using as much as we could. So I think we're on the same, the squaring up part is where I get into arguments with people on Twitter. And I think that there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. You're chuckling because you've probably seen some of them.
Absolutely. But I love those Twitter debates, coach.
I am a proponent of toes at the target. I don't believe that turning your feet away from the target increases the ability to make shots, even though it does happen with some people. But at the same time, I'm not asking for perfectly square on every, there's wiggle room within all of this. And ultimately, toes pointed at the target means, are we creating energy at the hoop and straight up in the air? Because to me, those are the only kinds of energy that we give to the basketball that help us make shots. And
I agree with what you're saying, because again, it's more the concept of the term square up more than even the reality of the feet. But like, I give the analogy, like you don't see a baseball pitcher, you don't see a football person, quarterback throw the football and then move in the opposite direction after they throw it, or often, you know, move to the side after they throw it. And you see these challenges with so many shooters that, you know, it's where they end up after they shoot almost as important as where they start, right?
Right. And ultimately, we're trying to be the house in a poker game. We're trying to, like, the house doesn't win every single time. Like, Vegas is not Vegas because the house wins 100% of the time. Vegas is Vegas because they win 51%. And the margins are so small that when you can win 51% of the time as a gambler, you're going to be wildly successful. And as a shooter, if you can stack some of these mechanical things together to give yourself that 51% advantage, that's the difference between Klay Thompson and a lesser shooter, is some of these little details. And you don't need to have every single one of them. You don't need to split your aces every single time to win a particular hand. But if you split aces every single time, you're going to win 51% of the time and therefore make a lot of money.
No, that's a great way of saying it and easy to understand. So you said something earlier about mimic shooting motion in terms of planting seeds for your daughter.
Right.
I'm sure you've seen this with Daniel Cole, that he talks about the stare video concept of staring to learn, that if you deeply stare at something, it helps your task representation. It helps your understanding of what you're supposed to do. Have you ever done anything with type of stare video? And if you haven't, who would you consider the best model or one of the best models, maybe male or female, for, you know, a stare video type of situation?
I'll answer the second part first. Like, everybody asks who has the best shooting form. And if I'm going to give a template, it would look a lot like Klay Thompson. Mm-hmm. I just love how balanced and simple he is. And kids will come into my camp and we'll talk about getting our feet hip width apart. And most will say that it feels a little uncomfortable. And some will even go so far as to say, like, I don't see NBA players doing this. Like, Kyrie has his feet right together.
I love that argument from kids, by the way.
Yeah. And then you point to Klay Thompson and you say, well, here's one of the best.
Yeah.
And go look at Steve Nash when he shot free throws and mimic that exactly. Like, he's basically, in my mind, square, feet wide, and even weight dispersion between his feet, and became the best free throw shooter in the history of the NBA. So lower body, I would go with Steve Nash. And if we're looking for upper body included, then Klay Thompson. Now, how did you phrase it?
I'll ask that again. But for Klay Thompson, is his realistic for some to simulate? Because he doesn't do much rhythm from the lower body on up. It's mainly what you said. It's 80% elbow.
Right. Yeah.
Is that realistic for a young player or?
No. Because he is a two-motion shooter. And right. If I'm taking photographs of a one-motion shooter and a two-motion shooter and comparing the photographs, they should look exactly the same. A two-motion shooter, in my mind, is just strong enough to be able to have a slight pause at their set point and shorten the shooting motion. And all things being equal, I'm probably like 51% leaning towards I would prefer somebody to be a two-motion shooter if they're strong enough to do it. Just because it's a shorter, more compact motion and therefore less variables in theory. But it's 51-49 because I think it's such a personal thing. And especially young players, I think, need to generate the power from triple threat through their set point and maintain that power flow in order to shoot longer shots. And if an NBA player is comfortable with that, I would never suggest that they change. And if anything, I'm trying to tailor my teaching now to allow for, I worry that I'm subconscious or inadvertently emphasizing a two-motion shot in some of my teaching. And I'm actually trying to open up the wiggle room for either one and let players be more of who they are and who they're comfortable being while still changing some of the physics that need to change.
Oh, that's wonderful. And beyond the scope of probably an hour conversation to get into some of these things even in more depth, but that's great to get into because I know that I get asked that a lot about one motion, two motion, and you know whatnot. I do find for younger players, it's much easier to be one motion in terms of the flow of the shot. And that's why I was curious about that Klay Thompson situation, because clearly anyone would want his shot. And I agree, right. Like he's a perfect model. But the realities of that are that's probably more of a progression to get there than to start there.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's funny to me that people say, I think most of us agree that he's the perfect model or however you want to phrase that, but then still argue against some of the things that he does.
People love to argue. That's all, Coach.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to claim I don't either.
But. No, it's kind of fun. But long ago, stopped ever getting involved in any conversation about dominant foot or inside foot or, you know, whatever that may be. Because again, in my experiences, best players I've coached do all of it. They do all of it without me demanding one particular one. But, you know, if I was going to start from a base of teaching 80 kids in a gym shooting, then I'm going to focus on one technique for consistency of shooting. Now, generally, I choose two feet in that situation for consistency of two teaching. But do you start with something like that when you get in like a youth camp? Do you start with one?
It sounds like we're very similar. I teach off of a hop in the beginning, not because I believe it's the best way to do things, but I think it's the easiest way to learn to synchronize your legs. I don't think your legs should be a left leg or a right leg. They should be one unit of legs that ideally push evenly to push your body straight up in the air. And I think it's easier to learn to push evenly with your legs when your legs are setting up at the same time for a hop. That being said, there are situations where I think there is a correct inside-outside footwork, and then there's a lot of gray area where
a lot.
I honestly don't care what you do. If you have the time to do whatever is comfortable for you and it's going to increase the opportunity for you to make that shot, do whatever you want. And even if it's the fundamentally incorrect thing to do, if that helps you make the shot, do it. Now, if you don't have the time to do that, you better have at least a base level of comfort in a more efficient footwork. But like an open catch and shoot, whether you hop into it, step right foot, left foot, or left foot, right foot, I don't care. Make the shot. That's ultimately what we're talking about. And then, but hopefully be able to execute all of them when the situation calls for one in particular.
Yeah, that's great. Because I relate that back to the analogy about passing. And that's a debate I get into more with, you know, one hand passes. And
right,
it's like, why would we limit a player? Like, they're in that situation. We're not making the decision for them, whether it's their footwork or their choice of pass. I mean, the point is get it there, right? The point is make the shot, whichever it is. So I'm definitely in line with what you're saying.
So how much then at that age, or what age do you focus on the development? Like, eventually we'd like people to be able to make accurate passes, with two-hand chest pass, one-hand push pass, and like all varieties. That would be the perfect world, that everybody's able to do that. At what age do you move away from teaching the fundamentals, or do you just acknowledge there are no fundamentals right at the beginning? Like, what personally, what do you do?
Well, I mean, my daughter's only 7, but I hope she gets into basketball a little bit soon, because then I'll be able to tell you a true thought experiment, because I would start her right away from one hand. Because I think about the ability to pass with one hand as a separator of skill. Like, it really demonstrates skillfulness. So I could probably walk in a gym and put everyone on their weak hand, dribble drive down the lane line, and hook pass, skip it to the weak side, the top 5 players from that, because they've spent time with the basketball, right?
Right.
It's a demonstration of skill. So I value that immensely. And I would say that that is more of a fundamental in my mind than a two-hand chest pass. Because a two-hand chest pass, if I'm watching the game, when does that actually occur nowadays?
Right, right.
Like, maybe in the open floor hit ahead, but that's usually right off of a dribble for young players. And then if we're trying to pass the ball, you know, from the young players I work with in camp on up around the perimeter, we're trying to do it without a step, because the faster you can move that ball without that step or that extra half second, the better
right
off it's going to be, and the more open the shot's going to be at the end of it, hopefully, or the drive. So, yeah, I mean, I just think that we probably are in that process of redefining what a fundamental is. And I think that's a positive, because I think we do somewhat limit players in terms of their ability to be creative. And creativity being simplicity, which I've said over and over again.
And then, so are we going to get to a point potentially where the two-hand chest pass is the equivalent of the one-hand push pass 15 years ago, where now it becomes the thing that we have to teach later on?
Wow.
In a specialized situation.
I don't know if either one of us will be alive when that happens, but yeah, no, it's, again, like, I'm not a, you only have to pass with one hand or only have to pass with two hand. Like, I'm just the best solution, but I just find the passes that we pass that were traditional chest passes even are just, we put two hand, it's 2-1. It's 2 from your hip or 2 from kind of your chest. And then it's a little bit of a push outside your body or a hook outside your body. And
right,
that's what's taken over. And listen, this is all credit to coaches, because what's improved so much since you or I played basketball was the level of defense. Like 10, 15 years ago, when I did a camp or a clinic, I'd have to explain what a closeout is. I don't
right
have to explain that anymore. Like, coaches are teaching these techniques defensively, and clearly defense is easier to get good at too. So I think there's that part of it, that the defense at youth levels especially tends to be ahead of offense for most players, just because it relates to effort. But I just find that type of transformation of the game has necessitated a change in what we believe a fundamental is.
I would argue that defense is easy to get good at, because I never got good at it myself personally, but
well,
not even close.
Yeah. Well, and again, I tell this story all the time. I said, why was I not good at math? And I asked that question of campers, and they know at that point, because I fed them kind of the be a basketball, just be an earner, but they answer because I didn't work at it. And that applies to defense, your defense, or my shooting, or whatever it's going to be. I mean, all of this involves this focused effort, and a certain
exactly
amount of focused effort is boring. It's boring. And coach, maybe that's one of those questions we should get back to you with. How do you deal with that? How do you get players beyond that? Because no matter what, to be a good shooter, there's some of that focused effort.
Yeah. And one of the most accurate comments I've ever had from a player, I won't name who it was, but it's one of my great memories of coaching. We were about 4 months in, or 3 months into his rebuild. It's in the middle of August, and I traveled to his hometown. And in the middle of his free throw routine, he stopped and looked at me and said, man, shooting's boring. And I kind of chuckled and said, yeah, it is. And the joke that I now make in camps is shooting boring is a whole lot more fun than math boring. If math boring is more fun to you, then you should probably be at a math camp. And that's great. But I think that's one of the challenges of, like, how do you make these things enjoyable when it's not necessarily what you want to do? And then you add in levels of, early on, I try not to keep score or give a result as the reason to move from station to station, because I don't want players focused on a result. I want them to learn a new motion without having to worry about a result. So you've even removed one way to keep it fun, which is keep score of something. And I'm not going to pretend I know the definitive answer, because I don't believe there is one. I think there's countless different little ways, and you're tapping into the personality of each player to find out what will make it enjoyable for them, because there are some people who do enjoy the boredom of it, and they sort of get off on the idea of, I'm doing things that nobody else will do. And so you can play up on that on occasion. So.
Easy, coach. Next thing I'm going to see you go hashtag unseen hours and... Oh my gosh. I know. Well, we can just assume at this point that we're all working, right? We're all working.
I hope so.
Well, the good ones are. So, coach, I got two questions from members of Basketball Immersion, if you don't mind, and we'll wrap on that. But one of them was, what suggestion would you have about improving a player's shot who shoots from his belly button area? And this is for an older player, or would you just leave it? And I think that relates to what we talked a little bit about earlier, about the release points when you're younger. You did it for power, and then when you get older, you didn't change. So
right.
What's the best solution there, or one of the solutions?
One of the things I try, first of all, I would teach them where the set point is. Their set point is probably out away from their body with their wrist flat, and they're shooting a flatter shot, I would guess. And we want to teach them that their set point is more over top of their nose, and then I want them to, in a fluid motion, be able to find that set point in what I would probably use as like the first little point or marker that I would give them is it just feel like you're looking underneath the basketball as you're shooting, that we never want to feel like we're always looking over top of it. We want to feel like at a certain point we're sighting our target underneath the ball, even if it's just for a fraction of a second before our release. So keep the ball a little closer to your body, I think will also help. And then just try and get underneath it.
Because you were shooting when you were doing that. Can you just say that part again about what you just said? You cut out a little bit.
Okay. Trying to keep the ball a little closer to your body and making sure that you get underneath the ball, get sighting the target underneath the ball, even in the last second or a fraction of a second before your release point, that you're not looking over top of it constantly. Or you are getting to underneath it.
Perfect. That just like when we teach, we have to say things three times. So
yeah. Oh, 3,000 times. Yeah.
Yeah. Or more, of course, but no, that's good. And another question. And how do you correct a player's shot so the ball comes out with that perfect backspin? And I guess they're relating that to saying, does it matter? Does backspin matter? You know, a lot of players shoot it with no backspin, or there's a little bit of a, he says in this example, a side spin, you know, the fall throughs he says fall through, the shooter's still towards the rim.
Great. I love this question. Spin doesn't matter as far as the result, but spin will indicate whether you've shot the middle of the ball along your target line. And if the middle of your hand shoots the middle of the ball along the target line, you will get that pure rotation that all coaches love. And the reason we should love it is when you shoot the middle of the ball along your target line, the ball will go straight. And, what tends to happen with the players who don't have the pure rotation is they've shot anything but the middle, or they've shot the middle but not along the target line. So they're missing the combination of those two ideas together that will always create the ball going online. And so if the ball isn't spinning purely, that's an indicator that they're not connecting to the right part of the ball as they're releasing the ball, and therefore the ball is either going to go offline or they're going to have a complicated shot where right hand is shooting left hand is shooting right. And they're hoping those two things cancel out to straight, which just makes it tough to be consistent. So it absolutely does matter.
That's great. That's a great explanation. I've never heard it quite that way before, but I think as coaches, we know there's a bit of an issue, but we're not sure sometimes if it's that important an issue, because as you said, spin doesn't affect whether it goes in. It's
I mean, marginally, if it hits the back of the rim, that, but yeah, it's more the indicator that we've shot it along the target line. I think that's the advantage of being somebody that early on went into shooting specific, is that I got to focus on all these little things and learn them, learn why they matter. And whereas a head coach is, you have so many things within the game that you're trying to become a master of, that you can't possibly expect to know. So I'm hoping that the idea of having shooting coaches continues to grow, because I think we can be pretty valuable to helping head coaches win games.
Well, and people don't know this, and I guess I'm fascinated by that every NBA team does not have a shooting coach.
Right.
That was a surprise to me. And by and large, I assume if there's no shooting coach, then it falls back to one of the assistant coaches, or it falls to their personal trainer, right?
Right, right. And even within that, we all have our skills, our strengths in teaching. And when you're focused on the game as a whole, I think you miss some of the details. And a lot of correcting shooting is detail. So I don't know the game as a whole nearly to the level that the people that I work with do. But I also don't think that's my role in being here. I need to see the micro and correct the micro so that they can correct macro.
Well, and that's great, because you're not defining shot selection for a player. You're helping them make the shot when they're shooting the shot. And
right.
That's a great distinction for, you know, I think all of us to understand, because I think as coaches, as we alluded to earlier, we just try and do too much and we can't do it all. And we have to decide what we can maximize and what we can improve on. And, you know, I think that's awesome. So, Coach, any other thoughts you want to leave some of our listeners with? I know we're going to circle back at some point and have another conversation anyways, because we've got to have you back. But anything you want to leave with?
Yeah, I want to finish with just how valuable the stuff that you're doing is. And I love the questioning of fundamental ways of doing things. And we're not always going to, every single one of us, agree with every single idea. And we shouldn't. There should be debate. But I love the way that you attack different ideas and challenge the way that we've taught basketball. And I think I honestly believe you're going to end up on an NBA coaching staff in the short term, and if that's a goal of yours. And so thank you for sharing all that you're sharing as well.
Well, thank you so much, Coach. Again, it's been such a rewarding process. And I think about the level I've connected with so many people with, and this podcast is really another attempt to do that and to get into more depth, because I think that's the challenge, I think, sometimes in some of these coaching conversations. So I appreciate you sharing honestly and openly, and I encourage everyone to go to the show notes, but it's at Coach Dave Love is the Twitter handle. And then, and that's your Instagram as well, right? At Coach Dave.
Yeah, Love. Twitter and Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm really just trying to focus on those three.
Right. And then www.coachdavelove.com. Please go there. So many great resources. And again, the newsletter is worth it just alone, but Coach is a great sharer. So please reach out to him if you have any questions.
I do run my camps in Canada at theloveofthegame.com. And that's sort of growing and changing a business model slightly over the last year and into the future here. So
Were you in Australia too? Is that where I saw?
Yeah. I'm trying to use this opportunity to go to cool places and see new and exciting things, and then having hopefully regional coaches in different parts of Canada that will continue to teach the camps in the smaller areas that I feel like really need it, smaller towns or across Canada.
Brilliant. And thanks again, Coach. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Perfect. Thank you for your time.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.